The cars sped along the Mall, the broad boulevard that runs between Whitehall, seat of Britain's government ministries, and Buckingham Palace. The 775-room home of King George VI and Queen Elizabeth, its stone facade visible now at the far end of the roadway, dark with shadow. It was early evening, Friday, May 10th. Everywhere bluebells and primroses bloomed. Delicate spring leaves misted the tops of trees. The pelicans in St. James's Park basked in the warmth and the adoration of visitors, as their less exotic cousins, the swans, drifted with their usual stern lack of interest. The beauty of the day made a shocking contrast to all that had happened since dawn, when German forces stormed into Holland, Belgium, and Luxembourg, using armor, dive bombers, and parachute troops with overwhelming effect. In the rear of the car sat Britain's topmost naval official, the First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston S. Churchill, 65 years old. He had held the same post once before, during the previous war, and had been appointed anew by Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain when the current war was declared. In the second car was Churchill's police guardian, Detective Inspector Walter Henry Thompson, of Scotland Yard's special branch, responsible for keeping Churchill alive. Tall and lean, with an angular nose, Thompson was omnipresent, often visible in press photographs but rarely mentioned. A dog's body, in the parlance of the time, like so many others who made the government work. The myriad private and parliamentary secretaries and assistants and typists who constituted the Whitehall infantry. Unlike most, however, Thompson carried a pistol in the pocket of his overcoat at all times. Churchill had been summoned by the King. To Thompson, at least, the reason seemed obvious. "I drove behind the old man with indescribable pride," he wrote. Churchill entered the palace. King George was at this point 44 years old and well into the fourth year of his reign, knock-kneed, fish-lipped, with very large ears, and saddled with a significant stammer. He seemed fragile, especially in contrast with his visitor who, though 3 inches shorter, had much greater width. The King was leery of Churchill. Churchill's sympathy for Edward VIII, the King's older brother, whose romance with American divorcee Wallis Simpson sparked the abdication crisis of 1936, remained a point of abrasion between Churchill and the royal family. The King had also taken offence at Churchill's prior criticism of Prime Minister Chamberlain over the Munich Agreement of 1938, which allowed Hitler to annex a portion of Czechoslovakia. The King harboured a general distrust of Churchill's independence and shifting political loyalties. He asked Churchill to sit down and looked at him steadily for a while, in what Churchill later described as a searching and quizzical manner. The King said, "I suppose you don't know why I have sent for you." "Sir, I simply couldn't imagine why." There had been a rebellion in the House of Commons that left Chamberlain's government tottering. It erupted in the context of a debate over the failure of a British attempt to evict German forces from Norway, which Germany had invaded a month earlier. Churchill, as First Lord of the Admiralty, had been responsible for the naval component of the effort. Now it was the British who faced eviction in the face of an unexpectedly ferocious German onslaught. The debacle sparked calls for a change of government. In the view of the rebels, Chamberlain, 71, variously nicknamed the Coroner and the Old Umbrella, was not up to the task of managing a fast-expanding war. In a speech on May 7th, one member of Parliament, Leopold Amery, directed a blistering denunciation at Chamberlain, borrowing words used by Oliver Cromwell in 1653. "You have sat too long here for any good you have been doing. Depart, I say, and let us have done with you. In the name of God, go." The House held a vote of confidence by way of a division, in which members line up in the lobby in two rows, for yes and no, and file past tellers who record their votes. At first glance, the tally seemed a victory for Chamberlain, 281 ayes to 200 nays. But, in fact, compared to prior votes, it underscored how much political ground he had lost. Afterward, Chamberlain met with Churchill and told him that he planned to resign. Churchill, wishing to appear loyal, persuaded him otherwise. This heartened the King, but prompted one rebel, appalled that Chamberlain might try to stay, to liken him to a dirty old piece of chewing gum on the leg of a chair. By Thursday, May 9th, the forces opposing Chamberlain had deepened their resolve. As the day advanced, his departure seemed more and more certain, and two men rapidly emerged as the candidates most likely to replace him: his Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, and the First Lord of the Admiralty, Churchill, whom much of the public adored.